feeling offended by something someone has done or said. They sound like problems from today's world of political correctness, but they are actually very old troubles for us. For instance, after being publicly criticized by Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr challenged his opponent to a duel in the summer of 1804. That day, both men came together in a clearing by the shore of the Hudson River at Weehawken, New Jersey. In the course of that duel, many of you will know, Burr infamously shot and killed Alexander Hamilton. Less well known is the fact that as Hamilton crumpled, dying to the ground, his blood stained the exact same spot where 3 years earlier his firstborn son, Philip Hamilton, had fallen, dying to the ground at the age of 19 in a duel over the same sort of nonsense. To quote Al Mohler, wherever it exists, followers of Jesus Christ cannot buy into an honor culture. And if we step back from duels, for instance, and look at just these matters on a more general level, I like how Sinclair Ferguson puts it. If in the year, says Dr. Ferguson, if in the year 1512 you steal a sheep and you are hanged for stealing that sheep, the punishment has not fitted the crime. So, Dr. Ferguson says, let's have none of this nonsense that in the old days they followed biblical law. They didn't. I'm trying to imagine him saying that in that Scottish brogue. They didn't. The principle of the Old Testament law placed an absolute limit on punishment, and the punishment must not exceed the crime, says Dr. Sinclair Ferguson. So in times and places where people were executed for stealing a sheep, where a man's hand would be chopped off for taking a loaf of bread, or where two men would take up guns or swords against each other to resolve an insult, these are all examples of serious violations of the biblical standard summarized by Jesus in the opening of our passage today, verse 38. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Jesus is directly quoting again from Scripture. This passage, this quotation could be several. It's found in several instances in the Old Testament. Here's one, for instance. Deuteronomy 19:21 is a lengthier version of that. It required that in Israel, under Moses, when a crime was committed, the offended party would take the accused party. Both would appear before the priests. They would summon or invoke Yahweh, as we saw last week in oaths. And they would also bring together the judges who were in office in Israel, and the trial would take place. The judges would call and examine witnesses, and then the judges would pronounce a decision. And as they did, verse 21 is directed as a guiding principle to the judges. It says, your eye shall not pity. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. In other words, the judges in office in Israel were not allowed to pity people and just let them off scot-free if they were proven to have been guilty of some crime. But on the other hand, they were also not allowed to just hammer them however they wanted and assign any punishment that was out of proportion to the crime they had committed. Proper judgment requires punishment that fits the crime committed. The fancy title for this principle is lex talionis. Many of you know that term. It's the fancy Latin term for the law of retaliation. It's very well known today. It was well known in the ancient world. It was found widely even before Moses wrote the law. Most famously, it's one of the principles carved into the Code of Hammurabi, if you've ever seen that giant black stone, I think 7 or 8 feet long, and all the little cuneiform. The eye for eye, tooth for tooth is found in the 200 or 300 odd codes of law that are inscribed there. So it was taken a common principle. It was approved of by God and instituted in the Old Testament as well under Moses. And it's a good principle because it does two things. First, as we've seen, it limits punishments to fit their crime. It limits the amount of punishment that can be brought to bear on someone. But secondly, and more importantly, it takes punishment out of the hands of individuals and it places the responsibility for punishment in a separate sphere of authority where evidence can be evaluated, something approaching justice can be accomplished, something approaching objectivity. A third party will evaluate the evidence, make a determination, and hopefully something close to, in human terms, justice in terms of punishment can be measured and meted out. The bottom line is this: much of God's heart behind the eye for eye, tooth for tooth command was God's intent to stop personal vengeance, stop revenge from flaring up, and us as individuals taking matters into our own hands. The trouble is, of course, Jesus quotes the principle and then gives a different interpretation than the one the disciples had been used to hearing. That legal, very good and necessary legal principle from Israel under Moses had been misapplied and misused in Jesus' day. It had become, in fact, the opposite of its intent. It had become an excuse for people to take individual vengeance. When we want to pay others back for wronging us, we can pretty handily rationalize it by saying things like, well, I'm only trying to get what's fair, you know, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It's a mistake that ignores the exact purpose behind the command and sadly as common today as it was in Jesus' day. You can imagine all the shenanigans that can be justified and maybe rationalized by doing that little maneuver. Personal grudges, vendettas, family feuds, vigilante justice, insurrectionist movements, which in Jesus' day were a big pull. You know, we know this in the New Testament. There was a strong current of anti-Roman revolutionary zealotry, and that seemed to have been a particular temptation for certain of Jesus' disciples who were identified as from the zealot quarters, or the zealot movement. So he repeatedly warned his disciples to have nothing to do with it. This was the setting of Jesus' teaching here. He knew that, for instance, the Pharisees, because this is all counter the Pharisaical teaching of the day, the Pharisees had been teaching something different, a different interpretation and use, a free individual use of the eye for eye principle. They've been justifying all sorts of wrong actions, so Jesus sets the record straight. Verse 39, I tell you, do not resist an evil person. Now, in English, this doesn't really do justice to the wording there. We might literally translate it better. Do not retaliate in kind against an evil person. That idea of evil, the evil person has done you evil, is built into the idea of retaliating against them. Do not return an evil for an evil. Do not fight back with the same thing you are fighting back against. This is the idea of the wording. Now, we need to be careful we don't mistake Jesus' teaching and misapply his version of setting the record straight. For instance, Jesus isn't abolishing law courts. Now, that's one mistake that some have made in hearing Jesus' wording here. Jesus isn't talking to judges like the original command was talking to judges. Jesus isn't saying that if you're a Christian and a judge in the circuit court here in the county, that you just have to let everybody off. Don't worry about meting out measured and proportional punishments when people are proven to be guilty. No, that's your calling. Keep doing that if you're a judge. Jesus is not referring to that situation. And probably not, probably most important, Jesus is not forbidding self-defense. And this is a very easy mistake to make. Many have made. So I'll say it again. Jesus is not talking about situations of self-defense. If someone attacks you, if someone abuses or assaults you, do what is necessary and right to get to safety. Defend yourself if you have to. Involve the appropriate authorities as soon as possible. Those authorities were put in place by God for that very purpose. Jesus is not speaking about things like courts. And as we'll see, Jesus' wording is not describing self-defense situations. He's speaking about something much more frequent, much more ordinary. I don't know how many of you have ever had to physically use force to defend yourself, but those instances tend to be rare for us, thanks be to God. Jesus is talking about something that most of us will probably have to implement, have to apply every single day. Whoever slaps your right cheek, turn the other to him also. Many of you know that little detail. Again, we've seen him use it already, of the right side. That's an important detail here. If someone slaps your right cheek, that's not assault. And he is not slugging you. In order to slap someone's right cheek, literally, you are not physically attacking them. You are backhanding them. The right cheek is where you're backhanded. If you don't believe me, try it after the service, not with me. To slap someone on their right cheek means to backhand them. In other words, it means to insult them. It means to dishonor them. When someone does this to you, he is disrespecting you in a public, shameful way. When someone sues you for your tunic, it's the cultural way of saying he's really coming at you. He's coming after you. He's being malicious and petty, and in a way that's embarrassing you and reducing you to nothing. He's trying to make a lesson out of you. We might say he's really trying to take me for a ride. You know, in our vernacular, it's like he's coming at me. He's trying to sue the shirt off my back, we would say. When a Roman soldier commandeered a Hebrew into obligatory service, the law of their day, you and many of you know this, it required him to help that Roman carry his armor or carry some goods of equipment or something for 1,000 paces. The count is 1,000 paces, and historians tell us that's the original measurement behind our mile distance, 1,000 paces. When that happened, it was humiliating. It was certainly a big inconvenience, and it was being treated as a subservient inferior. When someone puts you on the spot for a loan, it can be very awkward. It can often be inconsiderate if it happens in a public situation. It's very rude to us, downright disrespectful also. Each of these instances is describing the same kind of thing that Jesus is getting at here. The natural human response, disdain, anger, indignation. Maybe that boils up and over into outrage. And the human instinct is retaliation. Retaliate, payback. You dishonor me, you take advantage of me, you treat me like I'm nothing and nobody. If you do any of these things, I'm going to make you pay for it because I'm going to pay you back. Retaliation. Now, the Stoics had a philosophy about this that was common in the first century and prior, probably. Stoics urged something sort of similar to Jesus. They urged resigned indifference. But inaction. You know, life is full of trouble. There's nothing you can really do about it except it. Detached endurance. And do what you can to avoid these situations. Pragmatists. I heard about those, Dr. Stower, this morning in Sunday school. You know, a pragmatic approach, you could argue, would maybe sound a little bit like what Jesus is saying. You'd be You can't effectively fight back at this moment. So temporarily comply, but always keep the slow inner burn. That seething rage just below the surface. Patiently wait for the right moment. Hope, and maybe one day, you can actually pull off an eruption of vengeance without getting caught. Jesus is not being a pragmatist like that. Jesus is not being stoical about this. He is, in fact, commanding an action in response, not passivity and not inaction. Jesus requires from us the kind of action that is, like many other things here, all the other things in this sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, true righteousness that exceeds the false righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. In each instance, Jesus calls us to give up retaliation and instead do something positive, positive action that is completely unexpected, unnatural, unarming. A response that is disruptive to the entire balance of power that we normally recognize and interact with in our world, actions that throw off all the normal dynamics of personal cycle of insult, injury, and retaliation. These are glorious but difficult words. These are demanding. Many people think this is the hardest part of the Sermon on the Mount. It's demanding, like bearing a cross is demanding. So when someone backhands us, when someone dishonors us or insults us, it's infuriating, isn't it? But instead of firing back, Jesus calls us to absorb the blow, bear the weight of that insult, and then present the left cheek. Of course, if the right cheek is struck first, well, that's a backhand. But the left cheek, that's a full-on blow. That's a punch. In other words, Jesus calls us to hang in there, to refuse to retaliate, and to refuse to escalate in the normal way. We respond with humility, forbearance, and long-suffering. If this thing escalates, it's not because I'm escalating it. If this comes to blows, that's on you. Here's my left cheek. Your turn, your move. Matthew Henry said it so wisely, it is the second blow that makes the quarrel. When someone comes after you legally, Jesus says, when someone threatens you, if they treat you thoughtlessly, cruelly, reply meekly, graciously. Respond with a gift, with a generous spirit, with some demonstration of care and understanding toward them. When someone around or above you treats you in a demeaning or belittling way, when it appears that they're taking advantage, when they compel you to carry the load for a mile and you know you've got to do it, take up that load and carry it another 1,000 paces. Remember, if you've ever gone running, I have this experience. If you've ever gone running with young people that actually like to run in the sun for fun, and they say, we're just going for a mile, and you think, I can probably survive that, okay. And they're just getting their stride, and you come around the loop, and they say, let's go too. When you had your heart and set and destiny set on only doing one, the second mile, it's not just a times two equation. It's not just doubling. It's harder. We use that phrase, we kind of cheapen it in our vernacular, going the extra mile. You know, it's like an attaboy. You know, you went over and above on something, you went the extra mile. But remember, Jesus is talking about something very different. The phrase originally meant something really costly, cross-bearing kind of stuff. Going the extra mile means doing double the amount of good to someone who is kind of forcing you to do it, when the second half is harder, and doing it for someone who is humiliating and demeaning you. Jesus says, when someone puts you on the spot, they treat you rudely, they are pushy, thoughtless, don't just turn them away. Don't teach them a lesson. Kindly regard them. Try to offer to help. Again, these are things that every impulse in us just wants to sort of soften and explain them a little bit away. It's kind of like, wouldn't it be nice if, ideal kind of stuff. Jesus' pie-in-the-sky vision. But these are real, practical commands from Jesus that he expects us to live out in our lives in the real world. And I may add, this is how the church conquered the Roman Empire. It took some time, but they did it. This was their manual. If you're like I am, you hear these words and you are afraid to take Jesus seriously. This is, frankly, scary stuff. I mean, even granted, okay, Jesus isn't talking about courtroom stuff. Jesus isn't talking about self-defense. But still, Jesus is talking about our lives as his disciples, wherever we find ourselves. Something in us is afraid to take these commands seriously and actually do them. If we do that, how will it go well with us? Won't people just take advantage of us if we start doing these things seriously? I mean, if I turn the other cheek, if I offer my left cheek, won't I just become a doormat to everyone? Won't I just invite trouble? Won't I lose all respect? I remember we had this discussion in the jail Bible study. So, I tell you what, that's the first time where it ever really got real for me. And these guys say, I can't do that. I will be branded immediately. I will be a target if I try this. Are you kidding me? Well, okay, we're not in that situation, thankfully. But in the real world where we do live and operate, we all fear the same sort of thing. I'll be a doormat to everyone. I'll invite trouble. I'll lose all respect. If I don't bow up, return threat for threat when someone comes at me, won't I just become, I'll just get bowled over. And I'll become a laughingstock and a byword, you know. Even the good, clean-cut Christian parents will cluck their tongues and say, kids, I don't know what he did wrong, but don't end up like that guy over there. The first time I willingly offer to carry a Roman soldier's armor for a second mile, word is going to get out. And from then on, every Roman soldier in town is going to be at my door. I won't have a moment's peace from then on. I'll just be carrying everybody's cargo everywhere. If I give freely to everyone, even those who are rude or pushy, even those I know will never be able to repay the loan, it's like raccoons, you know? And I'll die penniless and pitiful. We can't actually live this out, right? If we actually started to live these things out, who would defend us? We'd be defenseless. If we don't defend ourselves, who will defend us? I lift up my eyes to the hills. From whence will come my help? My help is from Yahweh, who made the heavens and the earth. It's almost as if Jesus expects us to live in a way that requires faith. It's almost as if, in order to be just, we have to live by faith. Almost as if the just, the only way they can live is by faith. There are words to describe the kind of people who know the blessedness of living these things out. They may be called poor in spirit. They may be called meek. merciful. They are those who mourn, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They are those who make peace. That's what this looks like in the real world. And because God is real and His promises are sure, that blessedness, it even kicks in now. Even while we're mourning, it kicks in and it becomes apparent in traces in this life. Those who turn the other cheek are not victims. And that's the big myth to bust here. This isn't victimhood theology here. Like we're talking about in Sunday school, the narrative of victimization and all that. Those who are slapped because they are helpless, well, they are victims. But that's not what Jesus is describing here. Those who are slapped and then turn the other cheek, those who take positive action, those who offer peace, that's strength. Those who respond to threats with sincere kindness, with generosity, actually returning gifts, they're not victims. They've gained the higher ground by responding that way. They're taking beatitudinal initiative with open-handed, generous humility. That's what it takes to salt the earth. It takes giving things up. Christ calls us in these verses, think about all the things that are required to sacrifice by turning the cheek, walking the mile, giving to the beggar. Time, energy, property, reputation, ego, hurt feelings, all sacrificed for the good of the person who has wronged us. So kids, apply this. Start with the kids. Whew. When your sibling does something unkind to you and they take your favorite toy and then they break it. When they wear your favorite shirt without getting your permission. When they say something unkind to you, instead of jumping up and doing the thing that comes natural, the shouting match, name-calling contest, Jesus wants you to stop yourself. Jesus wants you instead to learn how to ask a question. How can I love them in return for them doing wrong to me right now? How can I bless them even though they wronged me? How can you talk with them? How can you use kind words to tell them about what happened, to tell them they've hurt your feelings? Maybe they said something, maybe they did something, but not retaliate and not return ill or bad toward them. Young people, this challenging passage applies to you. It's been said that no species on the earth can be as cold-blooded as some middle school girls. What a tremendous challenge it is to turn the other cheek to a girl who has just used her words to stick a dagger in your back and twist it round and round. A person who, for whatever reason, has humiliated you, made you feel like nothing in front of other people, made fun of you, spread rumors about you, ruined your reputation. Everything in you will want to do the same thing that's in me and that's in others, all of us, what Jesus says we must not do. Verse 38, pay them back with evil for the evil they did to you. Now, I just said everything in you. That's not true. The Holy Spirit of God is in you. He wants something different, something more and better, but not something easy, something different. The hour will come when that person who has been so cruel to you will herself be stabbed in the back by a word dagger. Or maybe that guy will be gossiped about or embarrassed. That is your hour of opportunity. You have a decision to make at that moment. You can stand there and gloat in the sin of your flesh, or you can obey Jesus. You can actually reach out to that person and offer comfort Maybe you even stand up for them. Speak up. Deflect the humiliation. Bring some kind or encouraging word where it is least expected. One of the best examples of this probably plays out in sports. You get disrespected out on the field or the court or wherever by some opponent. You know, maybe the most cold-blooded, I should have noticed it, pickleball players. Good grief. You are under stress, fatigue, discomfort. It's all on the line. Emotions are running high at the red line. And then your opponent disrespects you. I encourage you to think about that moment as a training ground for your life in Christ. Shake their hand. Help them up. Don't play back dirty. Don't sweep the leg when you know the ref isn't watching. Return respect even when you're disrespected. Not quite a year ago at the NCAA National Wrestling Championship, Minnesota State College wrestler Daryl Mason upset the number 3 heavyweight wrestler in the nation, Sean Streck from Central Oklahoma. At the final whistle, Streck, number 3, shoved Mason in the back to the ground. It was an awesome thing. Mason, he just knelt there and he prayed. It was really awesome to see. He was pointing to heaven and just praying, thanking God. Streck stripped some sweaty sports tape from his socks and threw it on Mason. Mason just kept praying. He stood up. Instead of retaliating, he offered to shake his hand. Streck pushed Mason's hand aside and stomped off the mat. Thousands, thanks to YouTube, thousands upon thousands have watched that moment. I encourage you to look it up. It's stunning. It is powerful. You almost can't believe what you're seeing. I mean, your blood will start to boil. Beyond that, though, Mason spoke with Streck afterward and then issued a public statement on Streck's behalf. He urged everyone to forgive Streck for that poor sportsmanship. Emotions were running high, Mason said. He was disappointed. He'd lost in an upset, split decision. He just let his temper get the best of him. It was understandable. We're all human. Forgive him. Join me in loving and respecting this man. Now, I have no idea what denomination Daryl Mason is from. What his theology is, I have no clue where he stands on this issue or that question. But I know this, when it counted, that young man was a true Christian. He actually lived out the exact thing Jesus is talking about here in the heat of the moment. And it was so powerful. Not a single person left that arena. Not a single of the, I mean, probably hundreds of thousands now who have seen this video online has watched it and thought, oh, poor Mason, poor victim. He was no victim that day. There is power and blessing. Life comes from obeying Jesus in these things. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the peacemakers. This is world changing. This is community changing. This is family changing, marriage changing, soul healing, life-giving stuff. This is what salt tastes like to a weary world. Let's be faithful. Let's be salty. Please pray with me. I went longer than I wanted to in today's sermon. I hope you'll forgive me. I hope it was a blessing to you anyway. I'm always struck by Jesus' words of institution at this table, that it was on the same night in which he was betrayed, that he gave us the institution, the incredible gift of this Holy Supper. This is how Jesus acted when disrespected and betrayed. Imagine what your friendships will look like if you do the things he commanded in that passage in response to perceived slights. You know, like we were talking about in Sunday school, Lynn, the perceptions that we build up and then we respond. Imagine if you respond like Jesus. Your family relationships in the face of outright backhanded remarks, sarcastic words. Parents, your frustrations, your grudges that develop against your children. Children, sons and daughters, disappointments, resentments that build up against your parents. Imagine your marriage this year. If after every embarrassment, every thoughtless act, every biting little comment or jab, you just turn the other cheek and voluntarily go the extra harder mile, what would that mean for your marriage? Imagine your relationships at work with that inconsiderate, belittling employee, coworker, boss, your rude, insensitive neighbor. When someone wounds our pride, our ego, our honor, the blood rises, you know. We want to exact revenge. We want to bring back dueling. Teach them a lesson. Judge, jury, executioner. Remember Christ's call. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the peacemakers. Please pray with me.